This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I've been listening to a terrific podcast that seems especially relevant now. The podcast, Resistance, has been mostly devoted to the protests that started last summer after George Floyd was killed. Resistance is described on its homepage as a show about refusing to accept things as they are, stories from the front lines of the movement for Black lives told by the generation fighting for change. It's hosted by my guest, Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr. Several of the episodes are about founding members of the group Warriors in the Garden, which organized several large protests in New York last summer. Another episode is about the only Black man in the small town Harvard, Nebraska, who organized a Black Lives Matter protest and wondered if anyone would show up. One very personal episode is about host Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr.'s relationship with his mother. He grew up in Sierra Leone. His mother moved to the U.S. when he was 1 year old, expecting her husband and son to soon follow. But because of issues with their papers, Tijan Thomas Jr. didn't come until he was 8, and his father never made it. He died when Tijan Thomas Jr. was 14. Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr. got his start doing slam poetry. The best introduction I can think of for him and his podcast is to play his opening narration from episode 1 of Resistance. We'll start the interview after that.
When people all around the world first started going outside and protesting, I'm kind of ashamed to say that I was on my couch playing video games. I was tossing touchdowns in one game, then shooting people's heads off in another, and the most I raised my voice for anything was to talk trash to my friends over a headset. But it was during one of these games that my boy asked me, "Yo, did you hear about what happened to George Floyd?" I hadn't yet. But these days, your homies don't just ask you if you've heard what happened to a Black man you've never heard of, unless that man is already dead. And I really wasn't trying to hear that. And I know that it's important and necessary to talk about these things when they happen, but I just didn't want to have to think about that all the time. I didn't have the capacity for it. So I just shook my head and told him, "Damn, dog, that's crazy." And I went back to trash talking. A couple days later, though, as the protests got more intense, I kept thinking about this. And I convinced myself that the reason I wasn't out there protesting was because I didn't want to catch coronavirus, or maybe it was self-care or some like that. And I think those are valid points, but in all honesty, I know that I stayed on my couch because for me, I didn't think there was much use in fighting anymore. When I was in college, I went to some of the first Black Lives Matter protests in my city. I remember shouting the names of Trayvon and Tamir and Sandra and Akai and countless others until I lost my voice to tears. I remember crying on my friend's shoulders, spitting in the direction of cops. I waved signs, led chants, stopped traffic, wrote poems. It felt like I did everything. But it didn't stop this from continuing. So when this new movement met me on my couch, it low-key met me in a kind of surrender. As the weeks went by, though, I couldn't help but read some articles about what happened to George Floyd and the many ways people were standing up against it. And I kept seeing in story after story a common theme taking over the headlines, like teen girls organized Nashville's largest protests, or the Black youth leading the George Floyd protests. It wasn't all that surprising that young people were at the vanguard of this new movement. Aren't we always? Like, I think of Marcus Garvey, Bayard Rustin, Assata Shakur, Angela Davis, and a whole lot of other people. By the time they were in their early to mid-20s, they were already getting busy and shaking things up. But I was surprised at myself. Because when I looked at those headlines about this new generation of activists and organizers, my first question wasn't, "Wow, how are they going to shake things up?" My first question was, "Wow, how are they going to keep this up? How are they not going to end up like me, 27, on the couch, tired of yelling, and trying to drown out their anger and frustration in a video game?" So that's what this show is about. A thing I keep hearing over and over again is this time is different. But like, how? Other than the fact that a bunch of white people are protesting for the first time, how is this time different for young Black and brown people who are once again offering themselves up to fight? Because as the streets clear and folks return to work, and there isn't a pandemic forcing people to pay attention anymore, what will have really changed for us?
That was my guest, Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr., introducing the first episode of his podcast, Resistance. We heard him explain why he hasn't watched the George Floyd video. I spoke with him April 13th, just days after videos were released of Dante Wright being shot and killed by a police officer who said she thought she'd pulled her taser, not her gun, and Lieutenant Karen Nazario being pepper sprayed by a cop during a traffic stop, even though Nazario was in uniform and was calm and polite and tried to get the officer to calm down. I asked Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr. if he'd watched these videos, if he felt he could deal with watching them.
I guess the answer is like absolutely not, because I guess that size says so much, but it's like I already know what's there, and when I say that, I don't necessarily just mean that like I feel like I know what happened or I know the facts of the case, so I know like, you know, every single detail about why this is messed up. I feel like I know what's there for me as well. I know the pain that's there for me, and I know that it's a tender spot for me to visit and choose to revisit. And I choose not to put myself through that, because I know if I watch that, I'll just be frozen. Like I will just not really know what to do with myself, and frozen with grief and frozen with fear too. And I can't move like that.
I want to ask you about something that I know happened in your life. You had a friend, a college friend, I believe, who was killed by the police, and that was very traumatizing for you. If you're willing to talk about it, if it's not too upsetting to talk about it, can you tell us what happened?
It's hard to know where to start. Well, my friend was having a mental health episode, and he was going throughout Richmond with his clothes off. He was, he didn't have any clothes. He just took off his clothes and was running around Richmond because he was obviously experiencing something. And he drove onto the highway and crashed into a tree. And then he came out of his car. By that point, the police had been called, and the policeman got out of his car and tried to tase him. And it didn't work. And so the policeman decided to shoot him.
Were there any consequences for the police who shot him?
No, there wasn't. As far as I know, there wasn't. And for context, in a town not too far away from Richmond, there was a man who literally had the same thing happen. He was having a mental health episode, and he fought with the cop. They engaged with him for a while using non-lethal forces and took him in. And he was a white man. So that ended very differently. And it was around the same time.
And it's not like your friend, if he was naked, it's not like he had a hidden weapon he was going to pull out?
No, he was naked. It was just his body. He loved to work out. We would work out together. And so he was a big dude. He was, you know, he had muscles, and he like really appreciated those muscles. Like, we worked hard for those muscles. And I think the cop saw that, and he saw that he was black, and he saw it differently than the way we saw it.
Was there a video of the cop shooting your friend? Was it a story that became a news story? Did people chant your friend's name at protests, or was it basically just in the background?
No, there was a video. There was a video. There was a very clear, vivid body cam video. And I think some other people had taken videos as well. Yeah, and I watched that video. And for the longest time when it happened, they didn't know his name for a while. They had just been referring to him as Naked Man. But people who had been seeing it knew that this was him. People who knew him. And yeah, there were, when protests started in Richmond last year with the killing of George Floyd. From what I understand, people in Richmond definitely like chanted his name and, you know, showed up for him in a very meaningful way.
There's a great episode in your podcast, Resistance, that's about your mother and relationship with her. You grew up in Sierra Leone, and when you were one, your mother moved to the U.S. with the idea of renewing her visa and becoming a citizen. And the idea was you and your father would follow in a couple of years when your papers were in order. It didn't quite work out that way, but before we get to that part of the story, what did it feel like when you were 8 to leave your father and board the plane alone to go to a new country? Did it feel like an opportunity once you arrived?
Well, once I arrived, for a while it felt very cool. Like, it still had that allure because, yeah, America is, like, for the most part, it was really nice. Like, being able to, I don't know, watch cartoons on TV whenever you wanted. Like, all the kids stuff, I think I was, like, very excited about. But I think after a while, it felt like, oh, this is, like, totally different from what I had back home. Like, what I gained in, like, sort of material things, like being able to watch TV or like go to a good school, I didn't really have, but I lost just as much in like with time with my mom, because my mom wasn't really around much. She was working all the time. So that was something that I didn't really expect, was like not having the same kind of relationship with my mom that I had with my dad.
You grew up toward the end of the Civil War in Sierra Leone, and there was fighting for control of Freetown, I think, while you were alive. A lot of children in Sierra Leone during the Civil War were kidnapped and forced to become child soldiers. Were you exposed to any of that? Were any of your friends in jeopardy or orphaned by the war?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to fully characterize it because I was like a kid. But what I do remember was when the war came, things changed like really drastically, and we had to get out, and we had to get out of the city and go to like somewhere in the countryside where it was, you know, rumored to be safer. And one of the things we had to do was, like, my dad gave me over to one of the people that he knew to smuggle me out of the city. And the way we did that was like literally through the sewers. Like, we had to go down in the sewers and like walk miles until it was like safe, and then come up somewhere where it was safe, and then go meet whoever we were supposed to meet at the safer place. And yeah, I remember the shooting. I remember the fires. I remember the sort of uncertainty. And I was so young that I don't think I like really wrapped my head around it, because I was very much like complaining about things like not having the kind of food that I was used to eating, because we had to like ration food and eat very like kind of easy meals that were easy to cook. It was all of that was happening, but it was because I was so young, I think I was just kind of like experiencing it and hoping that, you know, the people that I loved and myself, I was just hoping that we would be safe. And for the most part, we were. But yeah, family members and stuff knew people who were actually really, really like ravaged by the war.
Do you think you were traumatized, even though you're saying, you know, you were a kid and, you know, it wasn't as upsetting as it might have been? You missed the food that you wanted to have. But do you think, like, on a more fundamental level, that it really was traumatizing?
Oh, totally, totally. I remember when I came to America, one of the things that I was like really, I didn't know where this came from, but open windows scared the hell out of me. Because I was afraid that bullets would fly through the window and hit me, or like somebody would be trying to pick me off through the window. And I always like ignored that feeling, but yeah, it was definitely like a result of the war, because one of the things we had to do was like hide underneath our beds when the shooting was like especially bad. And you just couldn't go outside. All the windows were closed. But still, sometimes, like, I went back home recently, a couple years ago, and there were still marks in the walls from where bullets had hit the walls. And that really resonated with me because I was like, oh, like this is literally, this was my childhood. And for some reason, I think I ignored a lot of that, but like it still, I think it definitely traumatized me.
Was the war one of the reasons your parents really wanted to move to the U.S. and to raise you in the U.S.?
Yes, it was. I came right after the war, and I had to go to lots of meetings with people talking about how bad the war was.
So that's why you were able to come, but your father wasn't?
I think so. I think that's what it was.
So when you came to the U.S. and you had to navigate issues surrounding race, how did you learn what race meant in America and how you might be perceived by some white people and relations with police, like all the things you had to be careful about that you didn't necessarily know about when you got here? Like how did you learn? Who taught you? Or did you learn just through experience?
Yeah, I fell into the trap that a lot of immigrants do, black immigrants, African immigrants even for the most part, do when we come here, which is that I came here and I knew that I was here to like get an education, like, you know, try to live a better life. And for the longest time, I don't really think I like engaged with race, and I didn't really engage with what it meant to be black in America. And I thought that I was like not black, or I thought I wasn't African American, and maybe that precluded me from whatever violence was going to happen, because I thought, oh, whatever happens, whatever kind of racism happens in this country is obviously directed at African Americans. It's not directed at me, because whatever the hell is going on here, I'm not a part of it, was what I think I was kind of thought to think by my mom and like other African people, which is like, we're here to like work and do what we got to do and keep your head down and just like grind, you know? And I think as I got older, I expressed those views to people, and people very clearly, other black people, and they very clearly told me, listen, when a cop sees you, he does not see African immigrant. He doesn't see Sierra Leonean. He sees black. Like, he sees you the same way he sees me. And when you're applying for a job, when you're doing all these things, people are not going to see you as separate from this, because you are literally just the same as the rest of us, and you're not higher than us, you're not better than us. And that took a while for me to like really understand. And I think it was because part of it was because like what I was saying before about there being a divide between like me being African and people being African Americans, and like not feeling quite accepted in that community because of my difference. But after a while, I totally was like, oh, like this is, they're right. Like we're all on the same side. Like there's no difference between like me being where I'm from and them being where they're from. And we're all sort of like faced with the same kind of threats.
When you came to the U.S., did you have an accent?
Yes, I did have an accent, but I worked so hard to get rid of it. And I was, because I think I really have an ear for sound, I was really good at like masking it and getting rid of it, to the point where like halfway through the school year, they forgot that I was an immigrant, and like they never put me in any English as a second language classes, because I was just like working so hard to get rid of it. And I regret it. I wish I still had my accent. I really wish I did, but I was.
Why do you wish that?
Because like that's who I was and that's who I am. And so for so like a lot of the time, I do feel very distant from home, and I do feel very distant from that part of me that I left. I feel like I left back home, and I feel like the accent is like a reminder of who you are, and it's a reminder of where you come from, and to own that and to embrace that, I think, is a powerful thing, and like But I was just so young, and I wanted to fit in, and I got rid of it. So I really regret that I did that.
Saeed, it's really been great to talk with you, and I wish you the best with whatever you decide to do with your podcast and whatever you decide to do in addition to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Saeed Tijan Thomas Jr. hosts the podcast Resistance. My next guest is actor Courtney B. Vance. He's starring in Genius, Aretha, the National Geographic drama series about Aretha Franklin. It's now streaming on Hulu. Vance plays Aretha's father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, the pastor of the New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit and a civil rights activist. Vance also co-starred in the recent HBO series Lovecraft Country. He won an Emmy for his portrayal of Johnny Cochran in the 2016 series American Crime Story, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. He was just out of Yale School of Drama when he co-starred, along James Earl Jones and Mary Alice, in the world premiere of August Wilson's play Fences, presented by the Yale Repertory Theater. When the production moved to Broadway, Vance moved with it. Fences won several Tonys, including Best Play. Vance was nominated for a Tony when he starred in John Guare's 6 Degrees of Separation. He won a Tony for his performance in Nora Ephron's play Lucky Guy, which opened in 2013. From 2001 to 2006, he starred in Law and Order, Criminal Intent. Let's start with the series Genius, Aretha, and Vance's role as Aretha's father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. The son of sharecroppers, Franklin became famous for his preaching and what was called his million-dollar voice. His reach extended far beyond church through Sunday radio broadcasts and record albums of his sermons. When he was establishing himself in the 1950s, he toured the Deep South's gospel circuit with his gospel caravan. When Aretha was 12, he took her on tour as a performer. The series is in part about the conflicts that developed between them over the years. Here's Courtney B. Vance as Reverend C.L. Franklin, preaching at the New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit.
I wish I had some praying people in here today. Y'all not hearing me tonight. Y'all not hearing me. Some people only want to trust in themselves. Some people put all their trust in their bank account. Some folks trust in the government. But ultimately, I said ultimately, I said ultimately, all those things will fail.
Yes, sir. That's right.
But I'm going to put our trust in the Lord.
I will trust in the Lord. Come on, say,
That's an excerpt from Genius, Aretha. Courtney B. Vance, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a terrific performance that you give.
Thank you.
It's a great portrayal of a very complicated man. So let's start with his preaching. When you listened to recordings of C.L. Franklin's preaching, what did you hear that you wanted to capture?
Well, everything. He was a self-made preacher. As you characterized in my intro, that he was a stepson of a sharecropper. So his stepfather gave him an ultimatum because he was running back and forth, literally running back and forth 10, 15, 20 miles to guest preach at small churches and then rushing back to get back to do his sharecropping chores. He gave him a choice. He said the pulpit or the plow. And he chose the pulpit, and the stepfather kicked him out. So he had to sink or swim. There was no safety net for him. And to see the heights that he reached on that after that very fateful day was to me was everything. It characterized his life, his choices to get where he had to go, and the people that were in his church. That's why they were so passionate about him, because he was them. He was everyone in Detroit. Most black folks, 99% of the black folks in Detroit, came straight up from Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas. They came up, and they were part of that great migration. So he was real with them, and they appreciated that, and they knew that church was a place where they could be somebody in the world, the white world in which they worked. They were nobody, less than nobody, but they knew when they came to church on Sunday, they were deacons and they were mothers and they had jobs and they had status, and everyone needs to belong somewhere. So he was somebody that connected, and I connected with that.
Let's talk about C.L. Franklin's voice, which you had to learn and understand for your portrayal. What did you hear in his voice and in the way he used repetition and just kind of savored words?
I'm churched, so I most pastors during that time, they did that. So that repetition was and is that black tradition of call and response, and it ties everyone together, ties a choir behind him, as they say, the choir behind him, together with the congregation in front of him. And he's enveloped in sound and family, and everybody knows what they're supposed to do. There's a person who gives the repetition of the certain words, and so it is a rhythm. It's a rhythm that just builds. I listen to hundreds of sermons of his because they're all digitized online, and I listen just to hear his cadence, his rhythm, his words that give me key words to keep me in sync with him, because we were shooting 3 and 4 episodes at the same time. So when I needed to be able to come right in at a moment's notice and preach, and sometimes extempore, and it is a testament to preachers at that time. I mean, MLK, who was Martin Luther King Jr., who was his friend, whenever he came in town, he stayed with the Franklins. I mean, he was famous for that first speech / sermon he had to give when Rosa Parks sat down on the bus. He had 5 minutes to get himself together at 26 years old and speak to and galvanize the crowd. So all preachers at that time were able to, at a moment's notice, just preach on anything and everything. And that's his training that he had when he was sharecropping and just, you know, dashing here and dashing over there. And it is a genius preachers at that time had to be able to connect with anyone and everyone on any topic and be able to take it, bring it back to the cross. So I love listening to his sermons, but I love church. So I love listening to all pastors and getting that word.
Reverend Franklin, Aretha's father, who you portray in the series, is such a complicated and ambiguous figure. On the one hand, he's such a galvanizing figure in the church and in the civil rights movement. You know, he recognized Aretha's talent when she was a child. When she was 9, he had her sing in front of the choir, in front of the congregation. Age 12, he takes her on tour on his gospel caravan, and she really learns how to perform. And she learns what it's like to be a great performer, because she sees great singers on this tour. At the same time, he didn't watch over her sufficiently on the tour. She became pregnant when she was 12. At least that's how it's described in the series. And also, he had a lot of affairs when he was married and when he was single. And I want to add one more thing. In the series, he's portrayed as having impregnated a girl when she was 12. And again, I don't know if that happened in real life, because so much of his life is really surrounded by rumor. And this might have been the kind of thing that was never confirmed. You can tell me if you know. So anyways, like, what's your take, and what's it like to play somebody who is such an ambiguous figure?
Well, it is. It's tricky. The 12-year-old in Memphis, the impregnating a 12-year-old in Memphis was true, which is why it's in our series. Anything else, anything that we can't confirm is true, we didn't put in our series. The rumors we didn't put in our series, but you know, I would start as I always do. I would start by, you know, just when you look at the time period, you know, judging C.L. Franklin and, you know, anyone with 2021 eyes is a little challenging, because anyone who came out of that degradation, out of that horror that was sharecropping south and headed north, was scarred. And the people who were harmed, you know, who were taken advantage of by white and black men, were black children and black women. So I look at that as I began my journey with C.L. Franklin, knowing that everybody was of color was harmed. You don't know a person until you're in their shoes, and there's nowhere for them to go and nothing for them. They get no relief from their pain, and they turn to the innocent ones. And is it right? Was it right? No, but it happened. I know that he's a human being, and human beings are flawed.
When you hear you're listening to, you know, the radio or a music app, and suddenly Aretha comes on, do you hear her differently now than you ever did before? Do you hear things that you didn't?
Of course. I just, you know, my mother, that was her era. You know, Aretha, Motown. We grew up, we were on West Grand Boulevard. We were 8 houses down from Motown, from Hitsville. So as children, we used to run down the street on the grass and just go sit on Hitsville steps and watch people coming in and out. Get out of the way, boys and girls. Get out of here. You know, they would say to us, but, you know, we don't know who was coming in there. But, you know, she wasn't, of course, Motown family. But, you know, knowing what I know now about her life, I just, it's amazing to me that she was able to keep going, you know, for years with as gifted as she was. She got two little babies at home, and she's kept going back and forth, you know, trying to crack into the business, as opposed to just giving up and going back and singing in church and doing the gospel circuit. You know, she could have done that. You know, we just assume, when you think about Aretha Franklin, you assume, wow, she's so talented. She probably came into New York and took it by storm. No, 7 years she was banging her head against the wall of trying to make it. She did not give up. She pushed past where everyone else would have gone to get to where she had to go, and she kept doing it. That's why she remained, you know, the film ends with Nessa Dorma, her singing Nessa Dorma, and we go, of course she did that. Of course, 2 minutes before we're supposed to go on, okay, I'll do it. Let me see it, just let me listen to it, because that was her genius. She could listen to something one time, or having something played one time, and she could recreate that on the piano or singing it. That's her gift.
So in terms of playing complicated people, let's move on to Johnny Cochran, who you portrayed in the American Crime Story series, The People versus O.J. Simpson. And Cochran, of course, was the star lawyer on O.J.'s defense team. You've said you didn't watch a lot of videos of the trial, and you felt you didn't need to. Why did you feel you didn't need to?
I lived the trial, the year-long drama that we all lived through. Those who were of age, who remember that nightmare. So I was intimidated to go back and to portray a person that everybody knows and has an opinion about. The way I approach acting is it's problem solving. Sometimes, based on who I am, the problem needs to be solved by delving into and doing all of the research and doing all of the minutia work and building from scratch. But with Johnny Cochran and People vs. O.J., I said, no, I don't. I'm just going to read Jeffrey Toobin's The Run for Your Life, I believe the name of the book is. And I'm going to stay away from watching footage. If I'm watching footage, I'm going to be, I'm mimicking. And I had to get to the place where I'm doing it and the scripts are great and people will forgive the minutia that I miss because they'll get wrapped up in the story. And I'm going to jump in. I read the book twice. I saw that his mother of her four or five children in his family, as she chose him, she knew that he would have the stomach to deal with white folks. And so she put him in an all-white environment and went to, I believe it was LA High. And then he went to UCLA and changed the rest is history. So once I saw that he was put in an all-white world and used that to segue out into to his life and his career, I said, got him, I know him. That was my journey. Detroit Country Day, scholarship, Detroit Country Day, Harvard, Yale, Fences. You know, so once I knew that, I said, I got him. I don't need anything else.
Let's hear a clip of you portraying Johnny Cochran. And this is part of your closing argument. So Mark Furman was the LAPD officer who found the bloody gloves near the crime scene while he was investigating the murder of OJ's ex-wife, Nicole Simpson, and her friend Ron Goldman. During the course of the trial, the defense presented tapes of Furman making racist remarks, not only making racist remarks, but kind of bragging about being racist. And Furman's racism became a key part of the defense strategy. So let's hear a scene in which you as Johnny Cochran are making the final argument for the defense.
But don't be fooled. This isn't just one officer. Mark Furman represents the entire LAPD. Now, you may not know this, but you are empowered. Your decision has a major implication both in this courtroom and outside of it. Things happen for a reason in life. Maybe that's why we're gathered together. Something in your background, your character, helps you to know that this is wrong. Maybe you're the right people at the right time to be able to say, no more. We can't have this. What they have done is disgraceful. O.J. Simpson is entitled to an acquittal. They have entrusted this case to a man who says he'd like to see all gathered together and killed. That is genocide. That man speaks like Adolf Hitler. Now, since you can't trust the man and you don't trust the people, is it any wonder in the defining moment in this trial when they asked O.J. Simpson to try on the glove and the glove didn't fit? It didn't fit because it wasn't his. If you don't stop this cover-up, who will? Send them a message. Let them know that your verdict will travel far outside these walls. Ladies and gentlemen, remember these words. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Nicely done.
Wow.
That's my guest, Courtney B. Vance, as Johnny Cochran in a scene from the American Crime Story series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Did you ever wonder if Johnny Cochran thought that O.J. actually did it, but he was going to give him the best defense he could possibly come up with?
I don't know. He could, but, you know, defense attorneys, they don't want to know that. They don't want to know if you've done it or not. It's a show. And people are always, you know, talking about, you know, Johnny, how he demonizing him for him get. I mean, that was his job. And it was Marsha Clark's job to prove that he was guilty. And she didn't do a good job, obviously. You know, and it was, it's so polarizing because it was a black man that was that got off, and it was a black man that got him off.
When you were first establishing yourself, so you the first thing you really did was Fences on Broadway. It was a really big deal. It won a Pulitzer Prize for Best Play. James Earl Jones and Mary Alice won Best Actor and Actress. Lloyd Richards won Best Director. So, I mean, that show was seen. But that was a show about black characters. It had a black cast. Most shows on Broadway were not about black characters. There were few, if any, black actors in them. Was it hard in film or on Broadway to find roles as a young black actor?
You know, I was blessed. I was at Yale at the time when Lloyd Richards was there, and he was the artistic director of Yale Drama School, the dean of Yale Drama School. He was the artistic director of Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut. And so the playwriting world centered around him. So for a black actor to be at Yale at that time, when my wife Angela Bassett was there, she was there his first year in 1980. She was his first class. And so, you know, for us to be there during that time period, and when Lloyd had set up around the relationships around the country of regional theaters and found a playwright who had a tool box full of scripts so that he could take the scripts and develop them and go around and have them go around to the various regional theaters. And so it was a world that had never existed before, and we were in the center of it. And, you know, it was interesting being at Yale at the time when we were in class and we were working on dialects and things. And there was we were doing these Italian and Irish and, you know, standard American English and English dialects. And we were like, what is this going to have to do with us when we go out into the world? But when we were coming out and being able to work in these plays with Lloyd Richards, and the white students there were like, but we don't have the opportunity to work with Lloyd Richards and you do. And they were upset with us. We were like, but do you understand that the whole world revolves around you and around your kind of classes and dialects and plays and things? And this is the first time we've ever had something to, why are you trying to take the? It was a real, real time period of dissension. Because Lloyd was changing the theater world in he and August. And it was an amazing time to be a black actor. So I was introduced into the world with Fences. So from that, I worked. And, you know, I had a very unique position. My classmates didn't have anything like that, you know, to be able to be introduced to the entertainment world, because everybody came to see Fences, everybody during that time period. So when I went into casting for anything, they were like, oh, wow, you're Corey. Wow. And that was, I had a leg up right there. So, you know, I owe my career to Lloyd Richards.
You got so much out of the Yale School of Drama. It led you to Lloyd Richards. It led you to Fences. It's also where you met your wife, Angela Bassett. You and Angela Bassett have twins. Being a parent must have been so different from your parents' parenting. Different generation. They were struggling, you know, financially some of the time. And once you and Angela Bassett both established careers, you weren't struggling financially.
Well, you know, our parents instilled in us some basic things that we carry on. So, as I said, the message is more important than the money. We are really about discipline and really about education and really about our God. And so we instill those things in our children. When they go into this world and the world's crazy, they have a sense of themselves. So our parents did that for us, and we're doing that for our children. So, you know, the world may be crazy. They go to the fancy schools, but they weren't raised that way. They weren't raised with limos going to, you know, here and there, and that we didn't take them to our events for that reason. So they would think that this is their world. This is not their world. I remember we were coming back home from a big event, and we were, a car service was bringing us back home, and the children at the daycare center in the evening, the place was on our way back home, and I said, let's stop and pick up the guy. I said, no, baby, please, let's go home. Let the limo go away. get in our car and go back and pick them up. This is not their world. Our world is not their world. And so they did not grow up seeing, going to, you know, red carpet events and going to our premieres and going on sets. And that's not your world. You go back home, redo your reading, do your chores, and every now and then we take them to something, to a premiere for a children's movie or something like that, and do a little red carpet thing. So it's something for them, you know. And then gradually, you know, I think Black Panther became the first thing that mommy and my wife let them, you know, really be a part of and go, you know, engage and go to the red carpet and do all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's a pretty big deal.
Yes, it was a huge deal.
Yeah. Courtney B. Vance, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Courtney B. Vance plays Aretha Franklin's father, Reverend C. L. Franklin, in the National Geographic drama series Genius, Aretha. It's now streaming on Hulu. We recorded our interview Monday.